Okay. As we mentioned last week, before we start getting into some of the depths of many of the different fascinating, fun, and interesting sugyot in Machshava that come out of the Mor Nevuchim and his debates with other major Rishonim and Achronim Bali Machshava, it's always important and very helpful to walk into the world of learning that you're doing with a better understanding of who you're learning about and what you're learning about before getting into the nitty-gritty to understand the context, bigger picture, and of what's going on, some of the background. It helps basically put the rest of your learning into perspective to understand in a deeper level what exactly is going on, and to better, really, you'll get a better grasp on the discussions at hand when putting things into the, you know, into the bubble and into the perspective that they fall under historically. So last week we really discussed the life legacy of the Rambam, who he was, where he lived, what he did, and what was so unique about him, and, you know, in a hashkafic sense, in a historical sense, what his major life works were. Tonight, I want to focus as basically the second half of an introduction. Last week was more the life of the Rambam, specifically, more historical, biographical. Tonight, we're really going to try and discuss an introduction to the Mor Nevuchim. We're going to try and discuss a little bit of Divrei Hakdama to the Sefer as a whole. So we're going to focus less on the biography of the Rambam, which we could see from last week, and focus more background, introductions, you know, structure, etc., of the Sefer. So as we mentioned last week, the Rambam published Mor Nevuchim in 1191, but started writing it in 1187. So he spent 4 years writing this magnificent masterpiece in the world of Machshava and philosophy, but it's not just that he spent 4 years writing it. If we remember what we mentioned last week from some of the Rambam's letters, the Rambam was incredibly busy on a day-to-day schedule. He, every morning, would go visit the Sultan and the royal court as their doctor, and then he would go home in the afternoon to find dozens of patients, both Jews and non-Jews alike, and then he would stay awake all night to write. So when he said he spent 4 years writing Mor Nevuchim, it was not just 4 years writing Mor Nevuchim, it was 4 years of writing in the middle of the night by candlelight because he was exhausted and spent all day seeing patients. So it really wasn't like this was, he sat down and he was writing a book full force. This is something, you know, yeah, that's whatever. Tangent, leave it aside. So the Rambam wrote, published in 1191, Mor Nevuchim, The Guide to the Perplexed, as it's commonly called in English, and he published it in Arabic. As he mentioned last week, almost all of the Rambam's Svarim were published in Arabic, with the exception of Mishnah Torah. Exactly. Mishnah Torah was the one exception that was published in a modern, you know, modern, we're talking, you know, 11th century Hebrew, but it was a language that, you know, it was more of a Talmudic Hebrew, if you want to use the term, than a modern, you know, Ben Yehuda style Hebrew, which didn't exist. So the Rambam, realistically speaking, wrote Mor Nevuchim in Arabic. What was important about the fact that he wrote in Arabic is the Rambam was very, very involved in the scene, if we want to call it, in the, you know, Egyptian world, you know, Spain, he was already a young boy, but in Fez and in Egypt, he was already involved in the world of, you know, he was in the Sultan's court. He was discussing, you know, he was involved in some of them with the major philosophers, theologians of his generation. He had conversations with them. He spoke to them. He was engaging with them in both debates, conversation, and discussion. So the fact that he wrote it in Arabic, A, helps the Jews because that's the language that they spoke. If he wrote the book in Hebrew, no one would have read it. They couldn't read Hebrew. The average Jew didn't know Hebrew. Only the rabbinic elite knew enough Hebrew, and that was really the Aramaic Hebrew language of the biblical text. Yeah. Historically, I don't know. I know that historically they say that Jews over generations have a higher literacy rate than non-Jews. Whether or not, you know, how true that is in statistics, I don't honestly know. But realistically speaking, if those that could read had a higher likelihood of reading Arabic than anything else. I don't know, like, numbers of how many people really could or couldn't read, but those that could, Arabic was their best bet. So, A, it was good for the Jews that wanted to read his masterpiece, and it was also an incredibly important piece when we deal with the quote-unquote modern-day academia of his generation. What were his friends who he was going to see and debate with and discuss things with the next week or a few weeks later in the Sultan's palace or wherever, you know, theologians meet up to have, you know, conversations. You know, in Chazal or in Tanakh, we say Shar Ha'ir, they're sitting by the gate of the palace. I assume maybe that was still true in 12th century Egypt. But the Rambam, by writing it in Arabic, it made it accessible to both the Jews and the non-Jews alike, which for the Rambam fits very much in with his overall life. We'll find it. We'll discuss it in a little bit. Another reason why it was written in Arabic. That's actually fascinating. But for now, we're going to assume it's really just for broader exposure, both to Jews and non-Jews alike. In the year 1204, the Mor Nebuchadnezzar was first translated. To date, the Mor Nebuchadnezzar has been translated to at least 10 languages. Could be more languages, to the best of my knowledge, based on quick searches online. At least 10 languages the Mor Nebuchadnezzar has been translated to. In German, Spanish, French, Polish, English, etc. And so it's really been a sefer that's been accepted and widely spread across the world. If you take any college courses in America, in the world of philosophy, the Rambam is a standard, you know, Maimonidean thought is a very standard college class in the world of philosophy and theology in the secular world. And he's really a groundbreaking thinker across the board. So in 1204, the Mor Nebuchadnezzar was translated for the first time by a man named Shmuel ibn Tibon. Same person who translated Rabbeinu Bechaye's Chovot HaLevavot, different Rabbeinu Bechaye than the Rabbeinu Bechaye al Torah. Ibn Tibon really is considered the authoritative translation at the beginning. Okay? There's numerous discussions why Ibn Tibon was considered the authoritative translation. One, 1204, Rambam is alive or dead? Alive. Still. Okay? The Rambam is still alive. So there's different discussions on, wait, Ibn Tibon translated the Mor Nebuchadnezzar while the Rambam was still alive. That led to two different schools of thought. Thought number one is that the Rambam hired him to translate his book. I just spent so much time, I spent 4 years writing a masterpiece in Arabic. I know that the Jews are probably not going to stay in Spain forever because eventually we're going to go back to Eretz Yisrael, or we're going to spend the rest of our lives in Galus traveling from country to country as the Rambam himself experienced. And so he wanted it to be in Hebrew. So one school of thought is the Rambam himself actually hired or requested Ibn Tibon to translate the book. Thus, if the Rambam asked him to do it, clearly it's going to be more authoritative. That's school of thought number one. The other general school of thought is, no, the Rambam didn't actually request of Ibn Tibon to translate it, right? Ibn Tibon was a translator. He translated the Chovot HaLevavot. He translated many other Sfarim we have that were written in Arabic into modern Hebrew. So Ibn Tibon was just the guy who was translating it. But two major factors. Even if the Rambam didn't actually ask him to translate it, the fact that he translated in the Rambam's lifetime shows us two things. One, if the Ibn Tibon translation was horrible and totally misguided, and he misconstrued and misunderstood all of the Rambam's theories, then the Rambam's alive. He would have at least published a letter. He would have said something. We would have some proof that Maimonides came out and said, hey, I know that my book was just translated by this guy over here. He doesn't know what he's talking about. This translation's not accurate, and we should throw it out. That's within school number two, is that the fact that it was written in his life, and we don't have any arguments from the Rambam or the Rambam's son, who we discussed last week, wrote a whole book defending the Rambam's theories, shows that maybe the Rambam himself had access to it and gave it whether it's a passive haskama, right? The fact that he didn't say anything, as we'd say in Gemara terms, shtika keoda, dummy, the fact that I did not say anything, it's as if I agree to it. So that's one way to look at it. The fact that Rambam never argued upon it, but he knew it existed. It was in his lifetime, then clearly it's good. Within school number two, there's a second subcategory. So we'll call it one, that the Rambam hired him to do it. B, so category two is it was in the Rambam's lifetime. Within category two, we have 2A, which is the Rambam never argued on it. And 2B is there's those who argue, I have not found conclusive proof if this is true or not, but there's those that say that I really don't know if this is 100% true or not, but this is a theory that I've seen and heard, that we found letters from Ibn Tibon to the Rambam where he basically asks the Rambam, hey, we're in the middle of translating your book. I see you wrote in Chelek Aleph, Perek Lamed Zayin, this. Is this how you understand it? How would you, if I translate word A into word B, is that actually what you intended? So within school number two, it was really published within the Rambam's lifetime. So maybe the Rambam didn't disagree. Or there's those that want to say Ibn Tibon corresponded with the Rambam himself, and thus it has the approval of the Rambam because they actually discussed it. They had correspondence. So if I discuss it with the author and he's giving me his 2 cents, then clearly that's going to be more authoritative because he's the one who actually wrote the book. That is our background for Ibn Tibon. Earlier on, there was a second translation by a guy named Al-Kharazi. It's less common and less, you know, it's less commonly used and known than the Ibn Tibbon one. And in the Hakdamas, we'll discuss in a little bit of the edition that I have by Professor Michael Schwartz, that he writes that the Al-Kharazi one is much less exacting. It's not nearly as good a translation. He basically says, when he did his translation, he says, I didn't even really look at it. It's not such a good translation. I kind of put it off to the side. Not so important, you know, academically, practically speaking. Not really the foundation stone for my work because it really wasn't so exact. So why should I buy? So we don't use it so much. But it exists. So those are the original two. Ibn Tibbon and then a little later, Al-Kharazi. We're going to kind of skip all the way to basically today, if you go into a bookstore and you want to buy a Mor Nevuchim, there's three major ones that you'll find today that are popular. There has been dozens more over the generations, but going to leave those aside. The three major ones that you'll find today in bookstores are one, the one written by Rav Kapach. Rav Kapach was really the Taimani Gadol Hador in the 20th century who brought the Jews from Taiman to Eretz Yisrael. He was the chief rabbi of the Taimani Jews, and he wrote a commentary on all of the Mishnah Torah, massive, massive Talmud Chacham, and he was the authority for the Rambam. His commentary on Mishnah Torah is very authoritative and fantastic. So he also translated Mor Nevuchim, and this is also published by Mossad Rav Kook. So you have a very high-quality publishing house with a Taimani Gadol, for whom the Rambam is the guy. So that one has gotten a lot of credit, Rav Kapach's. Number two is the one that I've here. This is a two-volume set by Professor Michael Schwartz from, I believe, Tel Aviv University. He's a professor of both Arabic and philosophy. So this is kind of like, hits both of his, like, you know, his specialties right in one area. He's translated a lot of the Rambam's works as well. He's translated some of the Igrot, and he's translated the Mor Nevuchim and other things. His is fantastic. One of the things I really like about it is he writes in the Hakdama that he used a lot of the different translations that exist, and he kind of came up with one that's written in a modern Hebrew that we can understand, that flows very easily. But on the bottom, he writes, he has footnotes all on the bottom that explain what he took from, what he didn't take from, where things come from. He explains some of the academic history behind the words, where things come from, why he came to said translations, and just other sources in Chazal, in the Rambam, cross-referencing other things the Rambam wrote. His footnotes are very, very good. And also academic. He's a professor. He's not, you know, it was an academic work more than a base medrash work, but a fantastic sefer. And Rav Yitzchak Shilat, who is the Rosh Yeshiva in Yeshivat Birkat Moshe and Malei Adumim. Rav Shilat, like Malei Adumim as a whole, as the Yeshiva and Rav Rabinovich, Zecher Tzadik Tevracha, in Malei Adumim, the Yeshiva there, the Rambam is the key figure. So Rav Shilat himself has spent most of his life, almost all of his books, Rav Shilat. Kind of like Tzomet Shilat on the other side of Modin, but he's a rabbi who is the Rosh Yeshiva in Malei Adumim. Okay? So Rav Shilat has numerous svarim where he's basically going through different girsot of the Mishnah Torah to find the quote-unquote most exact lashon of the Mishnah Torah for the Rambam. And he is, you know, you're really, really obsessed with the Rambam when you teach yourself Arabic to read the Rambam in the original language to then write a book to translate it back into modern Hebrew. Okay? So he's a Rosh Yeshiva who is a massive Talmud Chacham, and he really wanted to understand the Rambam better, so what did he do? He went out, taught himself Arabic till he was fluent in Arabic, so that he could read the Mor Nevuchim in its original language, and translated it into Hebrew, because he felt that none of the translations out here are accurate for me. So he learned Arabic to go translate it. Those are really the major three. Also in English, there's a lot of different ones out there. The most commonly quoted one in English that I've seen is by a guy named Pines. I think he's a professor, I want to say, from California, one of the universities in California. Also, two-volume work, but it's really fantastic. That's really the most authoritative one that I've seen in English. One other really interesting thing that I found for myself fascinating, I like the idea in particular, of Schwartz, in Schwartz's translation, because it was written in Arabic, and he's translating it to modern Hebrew, one of the things he always does is, he says, in any place where I can keep the Rambam's original language, I go out of my way to do so. So anytime the Rambam quotes a Pasuk, or quotes a Gemara, or quotes anything in, we'll call it you know, Talmudic Hebrew, or basically anything that wasn't Arabic but Hebrew, enough that we can understand it, he keeps it in and he leaves it bolded. So if you open up to a random page, you'll see there's random lines. I'm just trying to flip randomly. There's random lines that are in bold. For example, this page right here. You'll see, I don't know if you can see from there, there's some words that are bolded. The words that are bolded is, that's the original text of the Rambam, which is just, I think it's a brilliant idea where he says, I'm going to give it to you in modern Hebrew, but whatever part that I could keep authentic to the original source, I'm going to go out of my way and I'm going to bold it so that you know what's the Rambam himself. In general, this is what I personally use to learn. For Mar Makoma, for the rest of the year, I generally don't type up word for word the way Schwartz translates it. Generally, I'll find the way that Bar-Ilan's responsive project, Project Ashut, what they have their Marvin Ruchim, I honestly don't remember what it is. I think it's the Rav Kapach one, but I could be wrong. And I generally will use that one on the Marvin Makomos just because it's easier to copy and paste than to sit and write down the whole paragraphs as a whole. So another fascinating reason why Marvin Ruchim is written in Arabic, besides for that that's the language of the time, that's the language of the academia, that's the language of the Jews, who else has a random idea why else you would write in Arabic? Anyone have like a random theory? Interesting. It's not a Jewish book. It's a book about theology as a whole. It's a philosophy work, similar to the Rambam's medical works. Okay, yeah. Fascinating idea. That's awesome. I mean, they burnt his book anyhow in France, so I guess that if that was true, which is intriguing, I don't think it probably is, but that didn't really work because they still burnt his book in France. What?
He tried.
Yeah. Definitely an interesting idea to say that he wrote it in Arabic to hide it from the Ashkenazi Jews who couldn't deal with his level of borderline controversial topics. And so he said, oh, write it in a language they don't understand. They won't burn my book. Well, that didn't work, but very interesting idea. I don't know how compelling it is, like, historically, but it's definitely fascinating to think of it that way. The reason it is, and he writes this in his Hakdama, fascinating. The reason why he wrote it in Arabic is because he wrote the Mor Nevuchim, the three-volume work, as a letter to his student. As crazy as that sounds. The Rambam writes in his Hakdama, he had a student, Rav Yosef ben David. Okay? They learned together. He was a younger guy, and the Rambam says, he was brilliant, he was a prodigy, he was a mathematical genius, he knew the sciences, he was a serious Talmud Chacham, and we would learn together. And that was that. And then all of a sudden, this guy, Rav Yosef ben David, this young superstar prodigy, Torah, Umada, math, science, Torah, he's the superstar of the modern Orthodox world, coming through, and Rav Yosef ben David has to move out of town for some reason. So he can't continue to learn with the Rambam. So, what do you do when you have a question and you're not able to go to your Rebbe? I'm sure some of you have done this before. You have a question, you're not near one of your Rebbeim. So what do? You pick up your phone, you send a WhatsApp, hey, I was wondering, what about X? What about Y? You send an email, you pick up your phone, you call someone, right? So everyone here has done that before. You've texted someone, hey, I have a question, what about X? So that's what he does. Hi, Rabbi Maimon, Rav Moshe ben Maimon, I haven't seen you in a while. I miss our chance when we used to learn together. I have all these questions about the deeper philosophical, esoteric understandings of the world that we were discussing. But we didn't get to finish, and now I have all these unknowns, these unfinished sugyas in my head, and I'm more confused than ever before because we learned to start, but we never hit the climax. We never fully finished and fleshed out the ideas. So now I'm really confused. What do you think about X? And he sent them a list of questions. So, like every good Rebbe, the Rambam didn't respond for a while because it took him 4 years to write the book. Okay? So, the Rambam basically writes in his Hakdama. He starts off with, oh my God, this student is awesome. He's so smart. He's so great. Yada, yada, yada. He asked me this question. I can't respond just to answer your question because to answer your question is jumping way too many steps. You're asking me questions about Maisa Merkava, the sugya that the Gemara says, we can't properly explain it. So how could I explain to you the deep esoteric Kabbalahs of the Torah without first basically starting taking you through all the steps along the way? So he says, I'm going to write you a whole map that's going to show you the process, and you're going to be able to understand it all on your own. So 4 years later, the Rambam writes 3 volumes of Moreh Nevuchim and sends it back to a student. So he wrote it in Arabic, not just for academia, not just for the Jews of his time, but arguably, we could say, he didn't even intend to publish it. It was written as a letter from himself to a student. He never wanted to publish it. Just imagine if you text one of your rebbeim and say, "Hi, I was wondering, I mixed my cholent with a dairy spoon, or what day do we start to say Vatein Talu Matar on in Shmona Esrei, or am I allowed to put this on the plata on Shabbos? How liquidy? What liquid, etc." And your rabbi doesn't respond, and you're like, "Well, it was a question about Hilchos Shabbos. Shabbos is passed. The next Shabbos is passed." 4 years later, they send you a 3-volume work on Hilchos Shabbos specifically about your one question. It's like crazy, okay? It's like you forgot you asked the question. I'm sure Rav Yosef ben David forgot that he sent the Rambam this letter 4 years later, when all of a sudden this 3-volume work shows up at his door. Fascinating, but the Rambam himself says this is the story. So that's really, the basic reason why it's in Arabic is because he's just writing a letter to his friend or to his student. But definitely something I think we can kind of understand and relate to a little bit, that this was just how they spoke, and the Rambam says, "You want to understand it? I'll take my time to help you understand it." People argue that it must be that the Rambam intended to print it, because he never would have gone that far to write a 3-volume work as an answer to a student. I'm sure many of you had that also, where you ask someone a question and they're kind of haphazardly give you a half answer because they don't have time to really look into it. So it must be that if the Rambam basically says, "Here's a 3-volume work on your question," that the Rambam himself had a thought process of, "Hey, let me publish it," which also feeds into the idea that the Rambam himself had commissioned Ibn Tibbon to translate it for future generations. That kind of all comes together, depending on how you relate to those two ideas as the languages and why it was written as such, and how Ibn Tibbon translated in his life. That kind of is one theory that's out there. Okay. Two interesting debates. Is everything till now clear? Any questions? Awesome. Two interesting debates about the Rambam that kind of come out over here is, one, was the Rambam a Kabbalist? We mentioned earlier that he discusses many esoteric ideas. That's part of one of the things that got him in hot water. The fact that he goes on and elaborates to discuss Maisa Merkava, the story of the chariots and the Shemayim, etc., and the fact that he discusses Maisa Bereishit, the two basically deepest, most Kabbalistic and intense stories that we have as Jews, that the Chazal already tell us, we don't really understand them. And even if we understood them, we shouldn't be going out and teaching them in public, because they're kind of above our comprehension. So there's questions about, was the Rambam a Kabbalist? In general, when we think of the Rambam, we're thinking Rambam is a rationalist. The Moreh Nevuchim is the Bible of rationalism. How could you tell me the Rambam's a Kabbalist? He is the most rational, dry halacha. He wrote 14 books of pshat halacha, Mishnah Torah. This is all halacha. Okay, but there's Hilchos Deos that discusses certain aspects of Kabbalah. Moreh Nevuchim discusses different aspects of Kabbalah. So there's a really big debate out there. Is the Rambam a Kabbalist? Is he a rationalist who happens to just be a super genius, so he knows everything, so he discusses the other stuff? That's part of our whole discussion. And what comes out, interestingly, whether or not you hold the Rambam as a Kabbalist or not, is how do you relate to Moreh Nevuchim? I know similarly, that I know two Rebbeim who were teaching at the same time in the same yeshiva, the exact same Sefer. Two different Rebbeim were teaching the Ramchal's Dat Tvunot. One is a hardcore, brisker Litvak who does not believe in Kabbalah. And he taught Dat Tvunot of the Ramchal as is. The other one is a massive posig who is a Kabbalist who spends his nights learning Kabbalah. Okay? And he taught the Ramchal, explaining all the esoteric ideas of the Ramchal and elaborating on the Kabbalah and explaining the hidden and deeper meanings behind what the Ramchal's writing. So it's very interesting, and the same thing could be true with the Moreh Nevuchim, how two people could learn the exact same book. And depending on the glasses you wear when you walk into it, this is why the Hakdama is always very helpful, I find, depending on the glasses you wear walking in will affect so drastically how you relate to the book. Wait, is Moreh Nevuchim a Kabbalah Sefer? No, it's the Bible of rationalism. How dare you say the Rambam was a Kabbalist? That's crazy. What are you, out of your mind? That's part of our whole balance here. What do we relate to the Rambam? Is it Kabbalah? Is it rationalism? What is the purpose of the Moreh Nevuchim? How do I walk into it? Yeah. Well, the Ari didn't, like, live yet. And I guess if the Rambam was that good of a Kabbalist, then, like, maybe he knew the future. But... Correct, he would. We'll discuss that in his Shira Nevuah. We're definitely going to discuss Nevuah. Okay, definitely. He's not like talking about like Madonna, let's put on tefillin type of, you know, Kabbalah. Right. So if you're going to take a really rationalist approach, you could say the Zohar wasn't written by Rashbi and go through the whole academic approach of the Zohar is clearly not written by Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. It might not have even been written by Jews, etc. Definitely that's an opinion that's out there in the world of academia. Who wrote the Zohar, etc. But what type of Kabbalah was existing, right? The Ari, Kitvei Ari, the Etz Chaim, Rav Chaim Vital, none of that existed. There was no Chassidus, Rabbi Nachman, Baal Shem Tov, Chabad, that didn't exist yet. But we're talking about Kabbalah, whether that's practicing Kabbalah. The Rambam was a doctor, was he? He was sitting there writing amulets. I don't know, maybe.
He didn't, yeah, but...
As in, there's different levels of how are you going to define Kabbalah? You're right. Part of Kabbalah as we know it today, right? The commonly studied Kabbalah of the Kitvei Ari, Etz Chaim, etc., Pre-Etz Chaim, those Svarim didn't exist. That really Kabbalah took that next step with the Ari and his students in Svat in the, you know, early 16th century, 15th, 16th century. That was that shift of taking Kabbalah from Divrei Chazal, Zohar, Sefer, Yetzirah, and making it a little bit more, it's on the Parsha, we're going to explain it kind of Midrashim, etc. But definitely it's a question of how we relate to what is Kabbalah, how we relate to the Rambam. But without defining what Kabbalah is, how do I, you know, what Svarim and what type of Kabbalah? Is it like I can understand deeper things in the world? Am I giving you brachot because I relate to God? I know what God's thinking through Kabbalah? Is it, well, I understand deeper, you know, is it like this week's Parsha? Kabbalah says that in numerous places that Moshe Rabbeinu was a Gilgul of Noach. I don't know. Is that true or not? I have no way of proving it. Rambam on Gilgulim, also maybe we'll discuss that. So some of these things, what exactly are we going to call Kabbalah or not? Definitely an interesting question. Not so much for now. That's just one question I wanted to point out at the beginning, is what the Rambam held on Kabbalah. Was he a Kabbalist? Was he a rationalist? Will strongly influence the way you learn the Sefer. Okay, is that a question or just stretching? Awesome. Okay. The other fascinating debate, and this is another point that got the Rambam in hot water amongst Jewish rebellion, is the Rambam very often quotes his contemporary philosophers. What's interestingly debated is he quotes very often, in particular, Plato and Aristotle. Mainly Aristotle, but also Plato as well. What's unique about this is, yes, the Rambam was having discussions and he was involved in debates and talking with other philosophers and theologians of his generation. But Aristotle and Plato wrote their books in what language? Greek. The Rambam spoke Arabic. So there's a lot of discussion out there whether, you know, I have no way of proving one way or another. Did the Rambam actually ever see Aristotle's book? Did the Rambam ever see Plato's book? How, when the Rambam quotes Aristotle, is that, like, authoritative? Like, can I go out there and, like, say, oh, yeah, Aristotle's view of X is like this because I read it in the Rambam. So some people say maybe the Rambam didn't even understand Aristotle and Plato. He had it all wrong. Some would say maybe he didn't actually read Aristotle and Plato. Rather, there were translations, just like right now. We're learning Moreh Nevuchim with a Hebrew translation because none of us speak Arabic. So, too, the Rambam had read Aristotle's work, but he didn't read it in the original Greek. He read it in these, you know, colloquial translation into Arabic. He was familiar with the writings inside from the Arabic translations, and that is, you know, I'm sure people will say that he also spoke Greek, but I've not seen, you know, that is a commonly discussed theory that the Rambam also knew Greek based on where he was living, where he was traveling, you know, to pick up. They didn't have like one of these language apps or Rosetta Stone that, you know, you listen into on your computer. Like, if he wasn't in the country, it would have been very hard for him to learn a language. You know, there would travel wasn't so common. I've not seen any real people, like, proofs or sources that say he spoke Greek. I think the more accepted opinion is he read the Arabic translations. That's at least what I think. I find it impossible that he's going to... What?
Would that be bad, though? That wouldn't mean that he didn't read Aristotle. Are you saying that, like, when we read, like, Plato's dialogues, we're not actually reading them
because they're translated? Well, there's no such thing as a translation that's not a commentary. It's impossible to translate something 100% as is without... open up an art scroll Gemara or an art scroll Tanakh. That is Pshat plus Rashi.
Right, exactly.
Okay?
That's what they do, but if you're just teaching something, I'm going to translate it like word for word type.
It's almost impossible. When you want to take a word X in Hebrew, I could give you 6 words in English that could be. And depending on which one you use, gives a certain connotation that's a somewhat a commentary. It's impossible to really translate 100% without somehow giving, without skewing something a little bit. So that's why it's always best to learn something in the original language. If you have the opportunity and ability. That's why Rav Shilat taught himself Arabic to then go read the original Mor Nevuchim. Because there's a certain, if you're like really intense, if you want to understand something properly, you need to learn it in its original language. Yeah.
Never
mind. So whether or not, you know, how much weight does that argument really carry? How much does it bother you or not bother you? I don't really know. But I don't think the Rambam was, you know, making it up. Oh, I heard some guys on the street quoting Aristotle like this, so I'm going to now include that in my book.
Aristotle says in metaphysics, quote.
Right. So my assumption is that he probably read an Arabic translation. I find it unlikely that the Rambam is going to quote it based off of, you know, as we'd say in Hebrew, mipi ha-shmua, based on something he heard. I also find it unlikely that the Rambam was like fluent enough in Greek to read, you know, really high quality, you know, academic philosophical works in a language that he probably didn't speak. You know, if you want to tell me the Rambam was fluent in Greek, he was that, like, he was really smart. I would believe it. But practically speaking, I don't have, like, a good reason to go out and say, oh, the Rambam was fluent in Greek. Of course he read Aristotle. Like, it's like saying, just because someone's really smart doesn't mean they're fluent in other languages automatically. But it's just a discussion that's out there. You know, that I'm just bringing here is an interesting aside. You could take it or leave it. I don't think that really changes so much how we relate to the book. But it's something that's definitely discussed. Any questions? Awesome. If anyone has any questions, just raise your hand or just speak out. I'm not at all offended to be interrupted. Okay. The Mor Nevuchim, I want to discuss a little bit of structure. We're going to spend some time discussing the structure of it. And then we'll end off with a little bit of the controversy. And with that, we will then end for tonight, and hopefully, Bezrat Hashem, next week and moving forward, go to our original plan, as we did in the original 2 weeks, where we just kind of did things regarding the Chagim, Mor Nevuchim, Sugyot, and Machshava, taking major topics in the Rambam's philosophical thoughts, and seeing how different Bali Machshava, Rishonim, and Achronim discuss and argue, disagree, defend his sometimes radical, sometimes overly rational discussions. Mor Nevuchim is, when it was written originally as a letter to Rav Yosef ben David, was written in 3 chalakim. Today, if you open up any Mor Nevuchim, you'll see that there's 3 chalakim, chelek rishon, chelek sheni, and chelek shlishi, and in each of them, it is broken into perakim. There is some debate whether or not the perakim themselves were included by the Rambam originally in the Arabic one, or Ibn Tibbon included the perakim. That's, you know, Professor Schwartz says, you know, he doesn't really decide. He says, we know for a fact that in 1204, when Ibn Tibbon translated it, it had both the Chalakim and the Perakim. But we don't know for a fact if the Chalakim were just the Rambam and the Perakim were given in by Ibn Tibbon. He broke it up further. Or if the Rambam originally broke it up into Perakim and Chalakim. Professor Schwartz says, there's those who have different Perak breakups than Ibn Tibbon, but he says, I don't want to, you know, why should I accept some other Perakim breakup? And so the Perakim breakup, at least in Professor Schwartz's volume, is based off of the Perak breakup of Ibn Tibbon's original translation in 1204. Okay? Now I want to discuss a little bit what's in each of the 3 Chalakim, and as just an overall overview of what's in the Sefer, how it breaks up, and then we're going to see some of the discussions. So in Chalak Aleph, Chalak Rishon, The first thing the Rambam really gets into is anthropomorphism. Wow. God. How do we understand God? What does it mean, God? Does God really have human traits? Does he have emotions? What do you mean God has... That God has kavanah, he has intentions. We know what God thinks. What do you mean? We say, Becharona pecha, biyad Hashem, yad chazaka, right? Etzba Elokim. All of these terms describing God. You want to tell me that God has an etzba, he has a finger? The finger of God. Or as we, what do we say? On Pesach, right? Who are the old like art scroll translated Haggadahs. With an outstretched arm and like, you know, with like wrath and fury and... I forget what the other one is that like completes that like sentence that everyone knows, wrath, fury, and I don't know. Whatever it is. So the Rambam opens off with, if we want to understand God, what on earth is anthropomorphism? How does it apply? Does God really have a hand? Does he have fingers? What does this all mean? Did God really get angry? Is Becharona Pecha? What's going on here? The Rambam actually goes very far. We'll see this hopefully later. The Rambam says, whoever accepts Tanakh in a pure literal sense of, yes, God had a finger, God has a hand, right? Keser tefillin, hera li'anav, God's wearing tefillin. Yeah, he's wearing tefillin, of course. It's on his arm, it's on his head, of course God's wearing tefillin. The Rambam says, whoever takes Tanakh totally literally and believes this, he is a kofar, and he says that's not just that you're a kofar, that is avodah zarah. Whoever believes, this is the Rambam's opinion, that God has a physical body, and he has hands, he has emotions, that is avodah zarah. That's idolatry. You are a kofar. You can't be counted in a minion. You can't be counted for any dvarim b'kedusha. You're basically you're pretty bad. What do you mean? The pasuk says betz be'elokim. Okay, shkayach. Maybe that's just trying to help us understand something. That's like the Rambam opens off with this like really big rant of his on like a really loaded topic that like is clearly like this is where he's starting with, and he's, you know, starting off heavy, and then there's like a little shift. We start with this massive, broad idea, anthropomorphism, the role of, you know, personifying God. And then, excuse me, the next 30 chapters after this, right, we have the next 30 chapters are basically very, very nuanced, detailed ideas where the Rambam basically goes through different terms in Tanakh and tries to understand, like, what does it mean, getting to the root of what does this term mean. If I just open up the table of contents... Perek Gimel, Perush Hamilim, Tavnit V'Tmuna. Perek Dalid, Perush HaPa'alim, Re'ah, Hebit V'Chaza. What does it mean to look, to stare, to, you know, things like that? Perek Vav, Ish V'Isha, Zachar U'Nekeva. What does it mean? Man, woman, male, female. What are these terms? Perek Yudbet, Perush HaPoel, Kum. What does it mean? Kum, get up. The next 30 chapters really from Perek Gimel until Perek Lamed, these 27 chapters, are really detailed Tanakh-based understandings of what a word means. How does this word apply in Tanakh? What do we learn from it? What do we understand of it? We're not going to spend so much time on that, if at all. If anyone's like really interested in like linguistics, I'm not the person to talk about it. I just find that stuff boring, honestly. But that's just me. I had a professor in college for I take like Lashon classes on like Tanakh linguistics, and like he was obsessed with this stuff, and I was just like, I don't know what's wrong with you. And then he would make fun of me because I don't care about the most important thing at all. But whatever, doesn't matter. So then the first chelik also includes the Rambam's overall analysis of Jewish philosophy and mysticism and how they are taught. And he basically goes through and he selects different ideas of the incapability of masses to understand mystical and esoteric concepts. We have these crazy, intense, esoteric, Kabbalistic, mystical thoughts, but the vast majority of the world has no idea what they mean. And even if they knew what it meant, they couldn't properly comprehend it. So the Rambam basically then says, we have to approach them, thus he says, well, yes, these crazy esoteric thoughts exist. The average person has no clue what they mean. And he says, thus, if you approach learning Kabbalah, if you approach and enter into the world of mysticism without the proper background, without the proper knowledge in advance, then that's going to lead to heresy. It's going to lead to kfir. It's interesting because this argument of the Rambam against learning Kabbalah is going to be, we'll see later, is an argument used of why people should never learn Mor Nevuchim. The Rambam says, don't learn Kabbalah until you are super well-versed in Torah. Because if you learn Kabbalah too early, you're going to get really confused. You're going to go off the derech. You don't have, you know, to use the term, you didn't fill your stomach with shas and poskim. Lo male kriso b'shasu poskim. Then you're going to start learning Kabbalah. You're going to go off the deep end. I'm sure everyone's heard of or knows someone who basically just all of a sudden, like mid Shana Aleph, like dove like head first into the world of like Kabbalah and Chassidus, and is like a little like crazy. So that's something that basically the Moreh Nevuchim says, like you need to have a basic, a serious background before. And he says that someone jumps into Kabbalah without the proper background, he says that's one of the most serious transgressions. It's one of the biggest chataim you could have, because you're basically walking into a world unprepared, and it's only going to cause damage. It's not going to all of a sudden, right? If you don't have the basic background, you walk into the world of Kabbalah thinking you'll get all the answers, you'll only end up walking out more confused, right? If you were like in ninth, you were taking like ninth grade biology, and you're like, wow, this is really interesting, right? Ninth grade biology. Okay, you're like, this is so interesting. So what do? The next day, you go to your local college, and you walk into their PhD level biology classes, and you're like, what's going on here? You'll walk out more confused. You would have thought, what do you mean, I'm taking biology in my high school? Yeah, but your ninth grade biology is not going to help you at all to understand PhD level biology. It's only going to help you be more confused. There's steps to take. And this is why I would argue the Rambam puts this at the in Chelek Aleph, in the beginning, in the first third, and he only discusses Maisa Merkava and Maisa Bereishit in the third chelek, in the end. Because as I said earlier, the Moreh Nevuchim, he's basically giving us a gradual process in how to learn. What we're learning, how we should learn it, it's all kind of a step-by-step, you know, guide, literally, guide, the Moreh, it's teaching us how to get there. So that's why he writes here, don't do this, this is going to be a problem. So for anyone who like opens up the Moreh Nevuchim, like, oh my God, Maisa Merkava, they skip straight to the Perek on Maisa Merkava, the Rambam would be very, very upset at that person. The last major thing that can be found in Chelek Aleph is the Rambam famously ends Chelek Aleph with a very, very sharp rebuttal to the Islamic teachings of Kalam. Both, there was, this is like a historical and philosophical part that I'm not remotely familiar with. Apparently the Islamic teachings of Kalam became very accepted by some of the Jewish thought thinkers of their time. And so the Rambam basically denounces both Jewish Kalamism and Islamic Kalamism. More than that, I honestly don't understand. But if anyone is familiar with Kalamism, I would love to be more enlightened. Yeah.
Sorry, what's Kalamism?
I just said, I honestly don't know. It was an Islamic philosophy of the generation that was something that was going on. I don't know more than that. I know that it was accepted by certain Jewish thinkers. So there's, in the world of Kalamism, there's Jewish Kalamism and there's Islamic Kalamism, and the Rambam basically denounces both of them. More than that, I legitimately have no idea. But I'm sure it's interesting, but the Rambam really is not a fan of it. Okay? That's part one, Chelek Rishon. Chelek Bet, right, starts to get a little bit more esoteric, a little bit more out there. The Rambam opens off Chelek Sheni with an exposition on the physical structures of the world and the universe. His world view based on the Rambam is incredibly Aristotelian, how we understand how the world is, the role of the universe, the sun at the center, the earth at the center, what's going on in, you know, the universe as a whole, what, you know, in the world, out of the world, etc. The spherical earth surrounded by concentric heavenly spheres, which we would call
orbits,
planets.
Oh, that's what you mean. No,
but
he talks about
Yeah.
Yeah. Nothing. The sphere, whatever.
Yeah.
I assume you both mean the same thing. And are,
just say it. It's fine.
No, I'm saying, like, I was going to say, the spheres, like, thing around the earth that everything is contained in, not the planets themselves, but, like,
it's like part of how we relate to like the world the world doesn't stand as in, it's not just this world. There's universes. There's many beings, or I don't know, not beings isn't the right word. There's many universes and how they interplay with one another and the role they all play is just an interesting, is very interesting discussion. And the Rambam then takes he continues in Aristotle's kind of overview of the world, and he frames them in a biblical and allegorical manner. As in, he takes what Aristotle's saying in a non-religious sense, and he's kind of malbish Aristotle's idea. he kind of dresses Aristotle in the words of Tanakh, in the words of Chazal, and he's kind of taking Aristotle, he's basically making like a from Aristotle on like understanding the world. So this is also an idea that gets people a little bit heated. And then, mainly, then the Rambam continues in Chelek Bet, discussing the different, you know, discussing the world, celestial beings, malachim, etc., the creation of the world, Nisa Breishit, how the world came about, what do you mean, what's going on, there were 7 days of creation, were there 7 days of creation, were there not 7 days of creation. He then discusses the age of the world, what do you mean, there were dinosaurs, no, there weren't dinosaurs, the world, you know, 5,781 years old, what do you mean, the world... We have carbon dating on fossils that are 6 million years old. The Rambam gets involved in that discussion. I believe the Rambam also discusses it elsewhere outside of the Mora as well. I think in Shemona Parakim, but I could be wrong on that. And the Rambam basically goes into this whole discussion of the world, celestial beings, the age of the world. And then he ends off Chelek Bet, Chelek Sheni, with his diatribe about Nevuah and Ruach HaKodesh. What is Nevuah? What isn't Nevuah? In a dream, not in a dream. What do you mean? There were people in Tanakh who said they had Nevuah. How does that work? What's going on? Fascinating thoughts of the Rambam about Nevuah. Then, Chelek Gimel, the third Chelek Shlishi. This part is really, it's the climax. This is the apex. This is what we've all been waiting for. I said the Rambam said, it's kind of, I'm going to give you all the answers, but you have to work through a process to get to the answers because you're not ready for it. So the Rambam then says in Parak Gimel that he opens off with Maisa Merkava in Yecheskel. Then, this is something the Gemara said before. It says, you know, these lofty ideas on Maisa Merkava can't be understood. They shouldn't be taught. And so the Rambam's answer seemingly is, it shouldn't be taught to someone who's not worthy. But if you've gone through my book properly, you've read Chelek Rishon, you've read Chelek Bet, by the time you get to Chelek Gimel, you're on a level that you should be able to understand these ideas a little bit. And that's kind of why he felt that maybe he could write the Torah secrets if he sticks it in at the back, that it would be okay because people have gone through the process first. Little did he know they would publish the book with a table of contents. People, they kind of look for big headlines that are interesting. Oh, Maisa Merkava, they go straight to the beginning of Chelek Gimel and boom, Maisa Merkava. Maybe the Rambam would not be so okay with that, but just an interesting thought. Then the Rambam continues and discusses different moral questions, moral aspects of the world, different quandaries and discussions that we've all dealt with. Is there evil in the world? Is there no evil? The idea of free will, trials, tests. What do you mean, nisyonot? Particularly, what are the two famous nisyonot that the Rambam discusses? What are like big nisyonot, tests and trials from Tanakh? The 10 trials of Avram, but particularly he really focuses on Akedat Yitzchak. The binding of Yitzchak, that really was a big focus point. What's the other big one in Tanakh? Eov. Job. Right? Those are like two major areas where the Rambam focuses on the world of trials, tests, how that applies with free will, not free will, what's the role of a trial, how does that work? The idea of divine prominence and right, an all-knowing, omnipotent, and omniscient God who knows everything, is everywhere, is everything. How does that actually apply? And then he basically ends off and discusses, as we spoke about in the first two shirim, discussing aspects of Sukkot and Tshuva. Then he ends off with going through these 613 mitzvot, understanding some of the reasons behind them, as we spoke about breaking the 613 mitzvot into 14 categories, and then basically going through and highlighting the Tamei mitzvot behind them. It ends off in a Jewish level.
Right.
I mean, like, you could say, well, he stuck it in at the end. He heard the criticism and stuck it in at the end. I don't think that's true. I'm just saying that's like an answer people could say. It's like it's an epilogue that they stuck in at the end, right? They made Star Wars 2 because they were trying to answer questions from Star Wars 1. I mean, I don't know.
Maybe it
was what? I don't know. I know they went back in time, they went future in time, whatever. Okay? Now let's, with the last, you know, six or so minutes, try and discuss. We mentioned previously, right, that's just an overall breakdown of the Rambam, his three views. Yeah, you have a question?
So I have a
Zoom in front of my family. Okay. If you have step out, I'm not, like, offended.
It's just my birthday, so.
Happy birthday and enjoy.
Thank you.
I'm not offended at all. Okay, let's try and discuss. Anyone have any questions on the overall breakdown, or we're good? Abigail Brooke, we're good? We have questions? No, I don't care. I'm just curious.
We're just fighting about Star Wars.
All right, if you're fighting about Star Wars, that fits into the idea of discussing the world and the spheres and what's in the heavens. Maybe the universes are fighting. The universes are fighting with each other, you know. I don't know, there's... Whatever. That also goes into Kabbalah. Do we believe in the Force, not believe in the Force? Ayin Shem. Okay, whatever. More than that, I honestly don't know about Star Wars, and I'll leave it at that. And I guess I'm Yotze, my, like,
yeah,
pop culture reference.
It's like Jude. It was, like, a whole, like, okay.
If you say so, now Yotze, like, pop culture reference, or, like, Star Wars doesn't count as pop culture anymore? Okay, great. Okay. Shh. Okay, we're not going to discuss more about Star Wars, because I've exhausted all that I know on the topic. And, yeah, I guess this is my fault for opening that that can of worms. And let's continue. The Rambam, as we mentioned, writing more in Nevuchim, was incredibly controversial. We discussed it was burned. Maybe this is why Rabbeinu Yonah wrote, you know, Shari Tshuva as a kapara for being part of the burning and encouraging it, maybe. Okay, within the Torah observant community, from literally the minute it was published, more in Nevuchim was a hot topic. It was, you know, it was one of these hot takes. Ooh, what do you think about more in Nevuchim? To the point that the Rambam's son refused to discuss it. Even though he'd written books defending his father beforehand, he would not discuss Mor Nevuchim until it was burnt. And only once he saw, wait, they went far enough to burn it, now I need a right to defend my father. I'm not going to get involved in the fight, but once you're going to go far enough to burn the book, okay, I'm gonna get involved. Seemingly very, very serious how we relate to it. Part of the, right, and in the world of today, you have certain places, certain Batei Medrash, where... and schools, Mor Nevuchim is a classic. That is like the first, you walk into Shana, you know, Shana Aleph, the first book you're learning is Mor Nevuchim. That's like the starting point. There's many yeshivas to this day where Mor Nevuchim is banned. You get caught walking in the Beis Medrash with Mor Nevuchim, your Rebbe's going to pull you aside and say, what are you doing? Why are you learning that? You're in a yeshiva. Okay, Mor Nevuchim to this day is a very, very controversial book. Whether or not yeshiva and seminaries are willing to have it in their base medrash, whether or not they're willing to teach it, right? I don't know of anyone today who'd be willing to go far enough and actually burn it. I'm not familiar with anyone who's that radical anymore, but there are plenty of people out there who will say, do not learn the Rambam. The main reason why people didn't like learning the Rambam was, as we said, mainly he was dealing with a lot of philosophical ideas that were not necessarily rooted in Torah, whether there's Torah view that what the Torah has to say about them or not, but he's, you know, maybe his starting point was Aristotle, Plato. He wasn't really dealing with a Torah topic. Maybe he's dealing with it, he's playing with fire. Why are you explaining Kabbalistic ideas? We're not involved in that. We don't need to be involved in that. Who cares? Why are we getting into that? You shouldn't be teaching it. You're overly rational, like in ways that maybe Chazal didn't ever have in mind. Maybe you're not rational enough. You're discussing Maisim Merkava to begin with. That's against the Mefurash Gemara. Many different ideas about just the Rambam as a whole engaging in certain discussions that people are saying, maybe it's better to not have these discussions. Two famous anecdotes about how the Mor Nevuchim was accepted. The first is, in Volozhin, when Rav Yisrael Salanter had started the Musar movement, right? 1800s, Musar movement, Rav Yisrael Salanter, really getting things going, you know, Navardic Yeshiva taking things to a new level, and Rav Yisrael Salanter approached Rav Chaim Volozhin or Rav Chaim Brisk from Rav Soloveitchik and said, why in your yeshiva, right? Volozhin, that's the yeshiva. That was the, you know, the biggest yeshiva, that's kind of where the best guys claim supposedly went. So, Rav Yisrael Salanter says, I want there to be a Musar Seder in Yeshivas Volozhin. Why are we not learning Musar here? And Rav Chaim Volozhin famously responded, medicine is for those who are sick. If you're not sick, you don't take medicine. Right? Rav Chaim Volozhin had a very, very simple thought. If you're struggling with a certain midah, then you learn Musar on that midah. You have a really, really hard time getting up in the morning, going to Shacharit, coming to Seder on time, showing up on time. So maybe you need to take out a Chovas HaTalmidim that discusses Atzlanos, discusses laziness and lethargy. Maybe you have you're struggling with, you know, different things, a shibu to smartphones, watching things that maybe aren't so appropriate, whatever it is, everyone has their struggles that they deal with. And so the Rav Chaim Volozhiner is saying, you learn, you know, you deal with mussar that relates to your problem. But if you don't have a problem, don't fix it. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Okay? If any, you know, Baruch Hashem, there is medicine out there that is life-saving. Chemotherapy has saved thousands of people. But if someone were healthy, were to start taking chemotherapy, IV drips, it would probably kill them very quickly. Okay? So Rav Chaim Volozhiner has a very, very strong approach. Mussar is for those who are sick. It's coming to heal someone. But if you're not sick, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So he's going to say, why should you ever walk into the world of the Moreh Nevuchim? I don't need to deal with it. A similar story is said in the name of the Chafetz Chaim. They say that the Chafetz Chaim once caught his son learning Moreh Nevuchim, quote-unquote, illegally. Right, he was hiding under his blanket at night under bed. You know, he was hiding in bed under his blanket one night. And the Chafetz Chaim walks in, he sees there's a candle under the blanket. Oh my God, fire hazard. Right, they didn't have like flashlights or cell phones. So he sees his son learning Moreh Nevuchim against his will. And he walks in and he yells at his son. What did the Chafetz Chaim supposedly tell his son? It's called Moreh Nevuchim. What is the translation of the word Moreh Nevuchim? The guide to the perplexed. So what does he say? He looks at his son and says, my dear son, are you perplexed? Are you a Nevuch? No. So you don't need to read the guide. You don't need to, it doesn't apply to you. It doesn't pertain to you. It's only going to hurt you. It's a guide for someone who's struggling, who's perplexed, who's confused. If you don't struggle with these issues, you don't need the guide. Right? Does it help you right now to go on Waze or MapQuest or Google Maps or whatever people are using these days? Does it help you to Google how to drive from the Great Wall of China to Berlin?
Yeah, it's knowledge. Don't you want more knowledge if you're interested in that?
No, it's only going to confuse you because you're trying to walk from here to the Modi'in Mall. So knowing,
you can make separations in your mind.
If I'm trying to get from Heichal,
Nachal,
I can't even read this with the tarp over there. You're trying to get from Nachal Zohar 24 to the Modi'in Mall. And you put that into Waze. And then you open up another app on your phone. You open up Google Maps because you have both apps because you don't trust one or the other. So you always check both, whatever. Okay? You then put into Google Maps, how do I get from the Great Wall of China to Berlin? And they're both going at the same time. They're both on the voice activated. Note that, you know, someone in your family always hates the voice. Just look at the picture, whatever. Okay? And you have both going at the same time. And you're, one goes, turn right. One says, turn left. It's only going to confuse you more. So if you don't have the struggle, you don't need to know it. It's only unnecessary knowledge that's going to come to hurt you. Okay? That's part of the attack. Hold on one second. And that's part of the question. Not only that, is taking it a step further. Not only is it unnecessary knowledge that's going to hurt you, if you don't struggle with emuna, you don't have questions in philosophy, in faith, you don't struggle whether in belief in God, whether or not God exists, doesn't exist, that's not something that you struggle with. So learning some of these theories, learning some of these thoughts, is only going to arouse curiosity and arouse doubt. Right now you have emuna shlema. So why should I ever walk into a world, when I walk into a world that's engaging in questions, you never thought of the question. The question never bothered you. So now the minute I ask you the question, the wheels in your head start turning, the things are chugging a little bit, it's starting to work a little, and now you're asking yourselves questions. Wait, does God really exist? Is that actually the moon over there? Or is that just a projection from the government to make us think it's nighttime? Wait, is it really, you know, does God say this? Does kashrut really matter? What's the purpose of the mitzvot? What's really, what happened in creation? Does God have a body, not a body? By starting to discuss certain questions, engaging in certain topics, you're only arousing doubt. You're only asking more questions. That's only going to help hurt you. If you have a question, if you have a doubt, if you have a struggle, engage in it. Work on it. And that's what the Moreh Nevuchim is there for. It's a guide for the perplexed. But if you're not perplexed, if you're not a Nevuch, the Chafetz Chaim and Rav Chaim Volozhiner will say, don't go near it. You don't play with fire if you don't need fire. You're more likely to get burned than to do something productive. That's the real main attack, at least in the modern world of the Moreh Nevuchim, without getting into the deeper philosophy of, you know, his ideas and what the problem is. But in a general approach, that's the real issue. What were you going to ask? Slash, because we're over time, let's finish up with what the Rambam actually intended it as, and then we could have these discussions later as those who are not as interested can go to Night Zed. Does that make sense? Awesome. The Rambam himself, in advance, really negates these claims. He writes, oh, I typed it in here. The Rambam writes in his Hakdama, in his introduction to the Rambam. I'm going to read it inside and translate because it's beautiful and it's very impressive. This is based off of the Schwartz translation. Dafka for this. The Rambam knows that these people are going to ask these questions. And the Rambam, right, you have a good question in Lamdas. What do? You could either address the question and, if you want to be brisker, right, you say that we're talking about two separate things. Another major way we work with Kashyas and Gemara and Sugyos is we redefine our terms, right? Everyone, have anyone heard that term before? If we want to understand why it's not a contradiction, what we're trying to do is we want to redefine our terms. It's not like we're trying to say, no, A is not the same as B because it means something different. So the Rambam in his Hakdama redefine, right? When we understand the word Navuch as perplexed, confused, misunderstood, whatever term you want to use, that's giving you an impression like the Chafetz Chaim and Reb Chaim Volozhiner saying you don't need it if you don't struggle. But the Rambam himself redefines the term Navuch before we even translate it into the word perplexed in English that gave us a biased view to begin with. And with that, I want to read from the Hakdama of the Rambam, I'll give you the translation of Schwartz. Ein matarato shel sefer ze l'hasbir et kulam l'tzibur rachav. The purpose of this book is not to go out and to teach the general masses. This is not a book for the wider public. V'lo l'matchilim b'iyun. It's not for those who are just starting out on their journey. They've yet to even learn. They don't know what's going on. They're just taking their baby steps in the world of Torah. V'lo l'lamed et misha ayin b'mada. B'mada Torah b'lvad. And it's not for someone who spent their entire life sitting in the Beis Medrash and the only thing they know is Shas and Poskim. They don't know anything else. The Rambam seemingly might agree that to teach it to someone who doesn't have struggles might not be the best thing to do. Dehainu b'halacha sheken matarat ha-sefer hazeh kulo. The sefer, the purpose of the sefer is much broader. V'kol ma shemesugo hi chachmat ha-Torah l'amita. The purpose of the sefer, it's not against the Torah. We're trying to understand the depths of the Torah in its deepest truth. Yeter al kein matrat ha-sefer hazeh l'ha'ir la'adam dati asher nikvah b'nafsho v'uzgah b'munato amitit torato v'asher hu shalem b'dato midato. The purpose of the Sefer is specifically for those, for the religious man and woman, for the person who strongly believes in his soul, in his heart. You believe in God. You trust in God. You know God. You believe in God. And you don't have necessarily questions. You're shalem b'dato midato. You're whole with yourself. V'hu iyein b'madei ha-filosofim v'yada'at mashmutam. But you haven't, you know, you're not just sitting in the Beis Medrash all day. You're familiar with the world of philosophy. You're familiar with the world of science. You also know what's going on outside of the tent, to use the term. You're holding in the tent. You know Shas from Brachot to Nida. You know Shulchan Aruch from Siman Aleph in Orachayim to the very end of Choshen Mishpat. You've been through the six Chalakim of Mishnah Berurah. You know the general ideas and the different Bali Musar and Machshava. You've gone through Tanakh with Rashi, Ramban, Ibn Ezra, and the other great Mefarshim. But you've also spent time, you have a doctorate in philosophy, you have a master's in biology, you have an undergrad degree in physics, you know what's going on in the world, you have a balance of Torah, you're also full of philosophy and external knowledge. External meaning, not Torah-based, necessarily. V'asechel enoshi, mashcho v'hevio latet lo et mikomo haraui lo. And because you're so broad, you're so knowledgeable, you're so smart, your brain, your natural inquisition, your curiosity tugs at you and pulls at you and says, hey, how does this all work together? Science says lice reproduce. Chazal say you can kill lice on Shabbos because they don't reproduce. How can I make that work together? Chazal say there's Bliya Bekelim. Wait, how do we understand the Teflon pots actually absorb flavor? These are questions that we're going to deal with. You know the science of Teflon. You know the science of lice. And you want to know, but how does that work with Chazal? That bothers you. Not because you have all these big questions in your emunah, but because you're so broad, you're so knowledgeable that the general concepts are difficult and you struggle with how it all comes together. You want to understand the deeper, the bigger picture. You want to understand how the tapestry comes together. If you've ever seen the backside of a tapestry, it looks like a balagan. But the minute you flip it over, you see how beautifully woven it is and the wonderful picture of the lion or whatever else is on tapestries. Okay? And that's something that's beautiful. And the Rambam says that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to get to understand the bigger picture. Okay? And the Rambam basically says, if you just look in the Torah, you're not going to find the answers because the Torah was not necessarily discussing all of these questions in depth. The Rambam, I would argue, we could explain that the Mor Nevuchim is the ultimate, if you want to use the term, modern Orthodox Datilu Misefer. It's a sefer for someone who is not spending their whole life ignoring Torah, just learning sciences. It's not someone for someone who's spending their life just learning Torah, has never once stepped outside the Beis Medrash. They don't know basic mathematics. They don't know biology. They go to the doctor, and whatever the doctor says they do, they don't ask questions, they don't understand. The Rambam says, no, it's for someone who has a deep understanding of Torah. You love Torah, you learn Torah, you live Torah. You're shalem with your emunah, you're whole in your emunah. You keep halacha, you're a religious person. But on top of that, not negating that, not contradicting that, but on top of your religious life, you're a master in the world of sciences. You know the world of the mathematics. You know the world of literature. You're familiar with the philosophy and poetry that's out there. And your questions, you're not navuch because you're perplexed, because you have all these doubts in your emunah. You're perplexed, you're confused, because you know so much, and you're working so hard, and your inquisitive, curious mind says, how does it all come together? And that's how the Rambam himself views Mor Nevuchim. It's for the broad Torah observant Jew who loves Torah, but also loves and appreciates the sciences and wants to understand how it all comes together. This is what the Rambam viewed Mor Nevuchim is. It's for someone who wants to excel in Talmud Torah, wants to excel in the world, the broader sciences and the world as a whole. Social science, hard science, different discussion. But the Rambam's saying, we want to take the different strands and bring them together and weave a tapestry. And then you won't be a Nevuch anymore. Because the Nevuchim, the questions that you have, it's coming because you're uncertain how it all comes together. We're trying to miyashev things. We're taking different things and we're bringing it together into a conglomerate to make a beautiful picture, to make a painting that's whole and happy. We're taking lots of little parts and making a sum of a whole big picture. That's what we're trying to do. We're coming together. We're taking the difficulties. But it's not because we're struggling with our emunah. It's because we want to understand how the world works, to better appreciate HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to better appreciate the world we live in. And by doing that, we deepen our religious identity. By doing that, we deepen our love of Yiddishkeit. And that's how the Rambam would say, Chavetz Chaim, Rav Chaim Volozhiner, I understand your kashyas, but you're missing the whole point. You also need to know science. You also need to know math. You also need to know poetry and philosophy. And this is Rav Chaim Volozhiner, maybe it's politics or not, who preferred to close the yeshiva than have them teach Russian. So that might be politics, czar, etc., different discussion in Jewish history maybe. And also if we have a Torah Umadah discussion. But particularly the Rambam as a whole is saying we're defining the term Navuch as someone who's broad. Someone who's knowledgeable, who has understandings of A, B, and C, and wants to know how it all plays together. And Bezrat Hashem, with this as a background, we should be zocha to have an incredible year where we probe and discuss and walk into some of the deeper discussions in the Rambam as a whole. Amen.